This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, December 8th, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. The attempts to regulate Bitcoin in the United States so far have largely been stymied. That doesn't mean it won't happen. Will Luther, an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, discusses a few of the arguments for regulating Bitcoin and how well they stand up to scrutiny.
Bitcoin has not really caught on as a consumer product for everyday exchange.
Yeah, that's right.
And there are now competing services with the new chips that phones have in them. You just had one of those phones out before we started recording. That Visa has its way of paying. Apple Pay has its way. Citibank has its way of paying using a phone. And it seems completely reasonable to me that Bitcoin, with minor adjustments by some entrepreneur, could be that kind of product. But there are some specific arguments for regulating Bitcoin that are offered by New York Senator Chuck Schumer, among others. So what are those arguments for regulating Bitcoin, and how strong are they?
Well, first, you're absolutely right. It's important to think about Bitcoin in two distinct ways. First, as a payment mechanism, and second, as a monetary unit. So as a payment mechanism, we're talking about how do you credit one account and debit another to make a payment. Electronic payments aren't new, right? You've had electronic funds transfers for a while now, certainly debit cards as well. And so you're seeing that technology be adopted in new ways, but it is, you know, an electronic transfer. The monetary unit is what is actually being exchanged. And so in the case of Bitcoin, it's this unit called a Bitcoin. In case of your debit card, you're talking about dollars. So there are those two unique aspects of Bitcoin as a payment mechanism, which I think you're right, that technology could be adopted to process payments more generally, not just in Bitcoin but with dollars. And you see companies like Ripple doing that. But the monetary unit is certainly distinct. Now, as for the regulatory justifications, they usually come in three categories. First is consumer protection, which can be articulated a couple different ways. Some people are concerned about the purchasing power volatility of Bitcoin. Others are concerned about how precise, how secure your funds actually are. And some are even concerned that the Bitcoin protocol doesn't allow you to issue chargebacks in the event that, say, you purchase a latte that had whole milk instead of skim milk.
Now, that I think is, if there is a compelling reason to regulate Bitcoin, that might be it, because there are, the money doesn't go to someone else until it leaves your account, and there is no mechanism, at least within the protocol.
That's right.
To do that. But of course, there are companies that are working to alleviate that problem and provide some build guarantees onto the protocol.
That's right. To some extent, that chargeback issue is a feature, not a bug, right? There are some places around the world where individuals don't have access to a sound banking system. And so Amazon would be happy to ship you a pair of alpaca socks anywhere, but they can't be secure that the payment they receive is going to be final if you don't have access to a sound banking system. And so having access to a currency like Bitcoin that doesn't enable chargebacks might actually be beneficial to some consumers, because now they can say, look, I've sent you the money. I can't get it back. Please send me the product now. And that might be better than the alternative they have. But you're right. Some companies have started escrow services. And so you send the Bitcoin to an escrow service, the package gets sent, and then the escrow service releases the funds. Once you've certified that you're satisfied. So although the Bitcoin protocol itself doesn't enable chargebacks, to the extent that chargebacks are desirable, individuals develop ancillary institutions to accomplish that.
And to some extent, that's built into a business's contract with Visa or other credit card providers. That is, we have written the law of how Visa is to be used between you and the consumer.
That's right. And, you know, we also have to talk, if we're going to talk about chargeback, we have to talk about chargeback fraud, which is a big problem to for small businesses. So, you know, one reason that merchant account fees are so high is because Visa, MasterCard, these companies have to deal with some chargeback fraud, and they build that into the price that they charge merchants to process transactions. And so it seems a bit odd that we should say everyone should have to pay for chargeback fraud because we're going to have chargeback and not allow some people to say, you know what, I'm not going to commit chargeback fraud and I would be happy using a payment mechanism that doesn't even permit me to make chargebacks because I don't think that that's a big problem for me.
What are some of the other justifications for regulating Bitcoin?
Well, I would say the biggest justification actually, and this is one that that Schumer has raised and more recently some economists, Eugene Fama and Richard Thaler have both basically concluded that Bitcoin is only valuable for crooks and tax cheats. So if you want to prevent illegal transactions and transfers, the idea is that you need to regulate Bitcoin.
Because you can move giant sum of Bitcoin as easily as you could move $5.
Yeah, perhaps even more easily, right? Because it's a digital balance. So you can send it anywhere around the world in a matter of seconds. So
how does that compare to physical cash as a means of enabling fraudsters and tax cheats and criminals?
Yeah, so there are two big issues here. First is the magnitude issue, and you're absolutely right to bring that up. So if you look at the Silk Road, that's easily the biggest marketplace for illegal substances that you could purchase with Bitcoin. And when it was in operation, the Silk Road estimates put the transaction volume at around $4.7 million a month. Now, that sounds like a lot of money. But in fact, in terms of the total amount of Bitcoin transactions that were taking place, I've calculated the Silk Road transaction volume to be just 0.03% of total Bitcoin transactions. Now, let's compare that with a dollar. So the best estimates of how much physical cash or the fraction of physical cash that's being used to support the domestic underground economy, that is those crooks and tax cheats that Thaler and Fama are presumably concerned with, that's around 48% of all cash in circulation. And so in terms of magnitude, if it's the crooks and tax cheats you're worried about, you should be much more concerned with the U.S. dollar's physical cash than Bitcoin's digital balance.
Isn't a part of that the problem of Bitcoin adoption? That is to say, Bitcoin is not that widely adopted, and therefore these avenues for using it in a criminal enterprise, isn't that part of the issue?
Well, I mean, so we're looking at the fraction of transactions of the total Bitcoin economy. And so you would have to if Bitcoin replaced the dollar entirely, then, yeah, perhaps you're right that, you know, if we're going to engage in this illegal activity, if we're engaging in it now, I don't think that Bitcoin would cause it to go away. And so yes, the illegal transactions fraction might increase. But there's another aspect of Bitcoin here that isn't widely appreciated by those regulators concerned with this particular issue. And that's the whole idea of anonymity with Bitcoin. So especially in the early days of Bitcoin, everyone said, well, you have an anonymous payment mechanism. So you have people purchasing pot online and we'll never find out who they are. But that's, strictly speaking, not true. Bitcoin is not anonymous. It's pseudonymous, quasi-anonymous perhaps, but not anonymous. Don't take my word for it. Just Google Ross William Albrecht, right? Here's a guy who was engaged in criminal activities. He was running the Silk Road, a site where transactions were conducted in Bitcoin. And he was arrested. They found him. He clearly wasn't anonymous. In fact, once you identify who the user is, you can see every transaction they've ever made. And so to that extent, it's less anonymous than traditional payment mechanisms, especially cash.
You know, I've had this discussion with Jerry Brito, among others, about this subject. And it's hard for me to figure out whether the fact that Bitcoin is decentralized, there are companies that make use of the protocol to build a business upon, but the fact there is no central company that members of Congress can shake down, I'm not sure if that puts regulation as more likely or less likely.
Yeah. So that goes both ways, right? On the one hand, you don't want to encourage identification for shakedowns. On the other hand, you might want to encourage identification for legitimate litigation. And so I think most people who are engaged in business activities where there is a possibility that litigation will be an outcome, they know who they're working with. They're not engaged in anonymous exchange. Anonymous exchange tends to be small value. You might stop into your bodega and buy a soda and a bag of chips without getting all of the identification information of the person selling you that, because at the end of the day, the scope for loss is pretty low. But when we're talking about large scale exchange, even to the extent that Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies would enable you to obscure your identity in just narrowly in terms of the payment mechanism, you're going to have ancillary institutions again that where individuals are identifying themselves outside of the payment mechanism in order to conduct those exchanges.
All right. So what is this other argument for regulation?
Okay. So the last argument for regulation is to promote broader macroeconomic stability. So there are kind of two aspects of that. One is a budgetary aspect. So the Federal Reserve is a profitable institution, and it remits almost all of its profits to the Treasury. If people started using Bitcoin and stopped using dollars, the Fed would earn less profit and therefore it would remit less profit to the Treasury. But practically speaking, the remittances are a pittance. In 2013, for example, it was just under $80 billion.
And that's a high number. Historic would be a high number.
Yeah,
historic.
Yeah, it's this is on the heels of the Fed massively expanding its balance sheet, purchasing mortgage-backed securities and other riskier but also higher return assets, and so they booked record profits and transferred record levels of remittances. So even in this very lush period of Fed remittances, we're still talking about less than 0.5% of current federal government expenditures, and so we're not making a debt. We're not making a dent in government debt by losing these remittances.
It seems to me that particular argument seems to be a little self-serving for, if not Congress, then the Federal Reserve, not because of these remittances, but because there is an avenue for hedging the U.S. dollar that no central bank controls.
Well, yeah. So that takes us to the second aspect of this promoting broader macroeconomic stability, the monetary side of things. But that justification, at least in terms of promoting macroeconomic stability, doesn't hold much water. On the one hand, pretty much all of our macroeconomic models find monetary disturbances taking effect through some type of sticky prices. And to date, prices are still quoted in dollars. And so even if individuals are using Bitcoin as a payment mechanism, they're not widely using the monetary unit. In fact, a lot of businesses who do use Bitcoin as a monetary unit, it's just on the front end. On the back end, they have a dollar value associated with the item, and it updates given the current exchange rate between Bitcoins and dollars. They even have some digital price tags that retail stores can use that update prices on the rack instantaneously given the current market exchange rate of Bitcoin.
And a lot of businesses that accept Bitcoin immediately turn that into dollars.
Yeah, they accept Bitcoin without receiving Bitcoin. So some intermediary like Coinbase will process the transaction. So you might pay in Bitcoin But the recipient never actually receives the Bitcoin. That Bitcoin is transferred to dollars and then sent on to the recipient. And so there's very little concern there, since Bitcoin isn't used as a monetary unit, that it would be generating macroeconomic instability.
Who wants to regulate Bitcoin? In my imagination, it's Visa and MasterCard and Discover and these huge payment processors.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that I'm willing to say that a lot of the regulation that's been proposed has at least initially been put forward by folks who are genuinely interested in the public interest. In fact, a lot of big payment processors and banks, especially early on, weren't too interested in Bitcoin or blockchain technology at all. They thought that it was going to, just be a passing fad, and that it couldn't compete with their business. More recently, a lot of these companies have decided, wait a second, this blockchain thing is actually an effective way of processing transactions, and so we should adopt that technology. And so they went from being naive and uninterested in Bitcoin or blockchain technology more generally to being very interested but proponents of blockchain technology for the most part. And so you see a lot of these companies adopting the technology, and so they have more of an interest in making sure that the regulatory burden isn't as high as it might otherwise be.
And in some countries around the world, it seems that as they're sort of grappling with this, especially countries that are developing, they've taken widely divergent views about how Bitcoin ought to be treated.
Yeah, that's right. So Bitcoin is banned in Russia. yes. And banks aren't allowed to, at least government banks aren't allowed to deal with Bitcoin in China. And so there's not a retail ban on Bitcoin in China, but there is this institutional ban. But elsewhere, it's either completely legal or uncertain as to its legal environment. And that uncertainty is perhaps more damning than the certainty that it's illegal, because there's a lot of just stop and wait going on, where you have all these gains that might be realized by having a better payment mechanism. But they're not realized because people are worried that as soon as they put in the investments to make use of this technology, that it'll be stamped out by regulators.
Will Luther is an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to this and other Cato podcasts with the new Cato Audio app for iOS devices and at cato.org.